here. I'm Nancy Reisman. I'm on faculty in the English department. And very happy that you could come out tonight to hear Deborah Eisenberg read. A few announcements in advance of the reading. The next reading in the series will be here in this room, definitely in this room, Buttrick 101, 8 p.m., November 28th. That's the Tuesday after Thanksgiving break. The poet Mary Leader will be reading here. There are also a number of literary events in the area in the next few days that I just wanted to mention to you. Tomorrow morning at the Nashville Public Library Auditorium, John Updike will be speaking. That's at 10 a.m. He's giving a talk about his literary career.
Saturday,
you're right. Sunday, 7 p.m. in the Shulman Center, Yiddish writer and Holocaust survivor Chava Rosenfarb will be giving a talk entitled A Yiddish Writer Survives the Shoah. And Monday, the 6th, Vanderbilt poet Rick Hillis will read from his new book, Brother Salvage, at the Davis Kidd Bookstore in Green Hills Mall, and that's at 6 p.m. After tonight's reading, we'll have a reception just down the hallway, and Deborah Eisenberg's books will be available at the bookstore's table in the Buttrick Corridor. And she said she's happy to sign them. Our guest tonight, Deborah Eisenberg, is the author of several books, including Transactions in a Foreign Currency, Under the 82nd Airborne, All Around Atlantis, and the very recent Twilight of the Superheroes. Among her other honors, she has received fellowships and awards from the Lannan Foundation, the Guggenheim Foundation, the Ingram Merrill Foundation, and the Whiting Foundation, as well as the Award for Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters and several O. Henry Awards. And she's now on the faculty of the MFA program at the University of Virginia. The writer John Edgar Wideman said that he thought one of the gifts, and for him the hope, of literature is that it's the best way we have of getting beneath each other's skin, of deeply apprehending lives and experience other than our own. For any writer, this is a tall order, and it's one of the reasons we're so lucky to have Deborah Eisenberg among us. Her fiction opens up and illuminates interior life to such a degree that readers inhabit not only the space of the characters, but the entire perceptual world. It's fiction of great intimacy, woven of metaphorical leaps, persistent questioning, and empathy paired with a sharp sense of the absurd. And it is truly masterful work. We're very honored to have her here tonight. Please welcome Deborah Eisenberg.
Thanks for coming out. If I'm not audible, let me know. And if I'm too audible, just make the adjustment. I'm said to write short stories, but actually my stories are very, very long. And I'm going to read you from one of them. From my recent collection, Twilight of the Superheroes. And I will read you what I hope is just about 40 minutes of this story. I'll read the beginning, I'll read the end, and I'll read bits in between, and I'll hope it makes some sense. But I want to get you a little oriented to this story. The protagonist is a man named Otto, who's in his late 50s or around 60, and he and his companion, William, have lived together for many years in a very nice apartment in the city. And he's an irritable person in general, but during the course of this story, he's particularly irritable. For a variety of reasons, most of which have to do with his family. And I also should tell you that Otto and William have upstairs neighbors named Margaret and Naomi. And Margaret and Naomi have just adopted a baby in China, and they're on their way home with the baby. You should know that. And I think that's all you have to know to begin with. And the title of the story is Some Other Better Otto. I don't know why I committed us to any of those things, Otto said. I'd much prefer to be working or reading, and you'll want all the time you can get this week to practice. It's fine with me, William said. We'll survive the evening with your... Otto winced. Well, we will, William said, and don't you want to see Naomi and Margaret and the baby as soon as they get back? Everyone always says, don't you want to see the baby? Don't you want to see the baby? But if I did want to see a fat, bald, confused person, obviously I have only to look in the mirror. I was reading a remarkable article in the paper this morning about holiday depression, William said. Should I clip it for you? The statistics were amazing. The statistics cannot have been amazing. The article cannot have been remarkable, and I am not depressed. I just happen to be bored sick by these inane waving our little antennae, joining our little paws to oh, what is the point? Why did I agree to any of this? Well, William said, I mean, this is what we do. Now, I'm going to go forward in the story, but backward in time, to one of the things that's really gotten Otto into a very bad mood is that his sister Corinne has called and is trying to convince Otto to come to a Thanksgiving celebration at her house, and she's trying to get Otto to bring their sister Sharon also. So this is Corinne on the phone. Oh, Otto, I just feel sad sometimes to tell you the truth, don't you? It's all going so fast. I'd like to see everyone in the same room once a century or so. I want to see everybody well and happy. I mean, you and Martin and Sharon were my brothers and sister. What was that all about? Don't you remember playing together all the time? I just remember Martin throwing up all the time. You'll be nice to him, won't you, Otto? He's still very sensitive. He won't want to talk about the lawsuit. Have you spoken to Sharon? Well, that's something I wanted to talk to you about, actually. I'm afraid I might have offended her. I stressed the fact that it was only to be us this year. No aunts or uncles, no cousins, no friends, just us. And husbands or wives, husband and wife or whatever, and children, naturally. But she became very hostile. Assuming William to be whatever, Otto said, why shouldn't Sharon bring a friend if she wants to? William is family, and surely you remember when she brought that person to Christmas, the person with the feet. I wish you'd go by and talk to her in the next few days. She seems to listen to you. Otto fished up a magazine from the floor, one of the popular science magazines William always left lying around, and idly opened it. Wesley and I reach out to her, Corinne was saying, and so does Martin, but she doesn't respond. I know it can be hard for her to be with people, but we're not people, we're family. I'm sure she understands that, Corinne. I hope you do too, Otto. How clearly he could see through the phone line this little sister of his in her 50s now, the six-year-old's expression of aggrieved anxiety long etched decisively on her face. In any case, she said, I've called. And yet, there was something to what Corinne had said. They had been one another's environs as children. The distance between them had been as great in any important way as it was now, but there had been no other beings close by, no other beings through whom they could probe or illumine the mystifying chasms and absences and yearnings within themselves. They had been born into the arid clutter of one another's behavior, good and bad, their measles, skinned knees, report cards, a barren landscape dotted with clutter, perhaps the life of the last dinosaurs, as they ranged, puzzled and sorrowful, across a comet-singed planet, was similar to childhood. It hadn't been a pleasant time, surely, and yet one did have an impulse to acknowledge one's antecedents now and again. Hello, that was us. It still is. Goodbye. I don't know, William said. It doesn't seem fair to put any pressure on Sharon, urging her to go to Corinne's. I'm not really comfortable with that. Oh, William, phrase, please, jargon. Why is that jargon? Why? How should I know why? Because it is. You can say, I'm uncomfortable about that, or that makes me uncomfortable, but I'm uncomfortable with that is simply jargon. Otto picked up a book sitting next to him on the table and opened it. Relativity for Dummies. Good heavens, he said, snapping the book shut. Obviously, Martin doesn't want to talk about the lawsuit. Why bother to mention that to me? Does Corinne think I'm going to ask Martin whether it's true that he's been misrepresenting the value of his client's stock? Am I likely to talk about it? I'm perfectly happy to read about it in the Times every day like everyone else. You know, William said, we could go away early this year. We could just pick up and leave on Wednesday if you'd like. I would not like. I would like you to play in your concert, as always. William took the book from Otto and held Otto's hands between his own. They're not really so bad, you know, your family, he said. Sometimes William's consolations were oddly like provocations. Easy for you to say, Otto said. Not that easy. I'm sorry, Otto said, I know. Just like William to suggest going away early for Otto's sake, when he looked forward so much to his concert. The little orchestra played publicly only once a year, the Sunday after Thanksgiving. Otto endured the grating preparatory practicing, not exactly with equanimity, it had to be admitted, but with relative forbearance, just for the pleasure of seeing William's radiant face on the occasion. William in his suit, William fussing over the programs, William busily arranging tickets for friends, Otto's sunny, his patient, his deeply good William. How spectacular he had been the first time Otto brought him to a family event, that gladiatorial Christmas 30-odd years earlier. How had Otto ever marshaled the nerve to do it? Oh, one could say till one was blue in the face that Christmas was a day like any other. What difference would it make if he and William were to spend that particular day apart? And so on. And yet, so steeled by new love, in giddy defiance, Otto had arrived at the house with William, to all intents and purposes, on his arm. A tidal wave of nervous prurience had practically blown the door out from inside the instant he and William ascended the front step. And all evening, aunts, uncles, cousins, mother, and siblings had stared at William beadily, as if a little bunny had loped out into a clearing in front of them. William's beauty and the fact that he was scarcely 20 had embarrassed Otto on other occasions, but never so searingly. How intelligent he is, Otto's relatives kept whispering to one another loudly, meaning apparently that it was a marvel he could speak. So, Corinne had said in a loud and artificially genial tone, as if she were speaking to an armed high school student, where did you and William meet, Otto? The table fell silent. Otto looked out at the wolfish ring of faces. On Third Avenue, he said distinctly, and returned to his meal. Sorry, he said as he and William climbed into the car afterward. Sorry to have embarrassed them. Sorry to have embarrassed you. Sorry to have shocked them. Sorry, sorry, sorry. But what was I supposed to say? All that interest, the solicitude. The truth is, they've never sanctioned my way of life. Or, alternately, they've always sanctioned it. Oh, what on earth good is it to have a word that means only itself and its opposite? Driving back to the city through the assault of Lee Scenic and demographically uniform little towns, they were silent. Otto glanced at William. No glance was returned. Back in the apartment, they sat for a while in the dark. Tears stung Otto's eyes and nose. He would miss William terribly. It was a mistake, he said. William gestured absently. Well, we had to do it sooner or later. We did? It was as if snow had begun to fall in the apartment, a gentle, chiming, twinkling snow, and sitting there, looking at one another silently, it became apparent that what each was facing was his future. Now, I will skip ahead to Otto and William have indeed gone to see Sharon, Otto's sister, with the purpose of persuading her to come to Thanksgiving. And Otto is here thinking about Sharon. Can you hear over there? Okay. So Otto is thinking about Sharon. At school, Sharon had shown an astounding talent for the sciences, for everything, for mathematics especially. Her mind was so rarefied, so crystalline, so adventurous, that none of the rest of them could begin to follow. She soared into graduate school, practically still a child. She was one of the few blessed people, it seemed, whose destiny was clear. Her professors were astonished by her leaps of thought, by the finesse and elegance of her insights. She arrived at hypotheses by sheer intuition and with what eventually one of her mentors described as an almost alarming speed. She was like a dancer, he said, out in the cosmos, springing weightlessly from star to star. Drones, merely brilliant, crawled along behind with laborious proofs that supported her assertions. A tremendous capacity for metaphor, Otto assumed it was, a tremendous sensitivity to the deep structures of the universe. He himself was so literal-minded he couldn't understand the simplest scientific or mathematical formulation. Plain old electricity, for example, with its amps and volts and charges and conductivity. Metaphors, presumably. Metaphors to describe some ectoplasmic tiger in the walls, just spoiling to shoot through the wires the instant the cage door was opened and out into the bulb. And molecules? What on earth were people talking about? If the table was actually just a bunch of swarming motes bound to one another by nothing more than some amicable commonality of form, then why didn't your teacup go crashing through it? But from the time she was tiny, Sharon seemed to be in kindly, lighthearted communion with the occult substances that lay far within and far beyond the human body. It was all as easy for her as reading was for him. The only truly pleasurable moments at the family dinner table were those rare occasions when Sharon would talk. He remembered one evening, she would have been in grade school, she was wearing a red sweater, pink barrettes held back her hair. She was speaking of holes in space. Holes in nothing. No, not in nothing, Sharon explained patiently, in space. And the others older and larger, laid down their speared meat and listened, uncomprehending and entranced, as though to distant, wordless singing. Perhaps, Otto sometimes consoled himself, they could be forgiven for failing to identify the beginnings. How could the rest of them, with their ordinary intellects, have followed Sharon's rapid and arcane speculations, her penetrating apperceptions, closely enough to identify with any certainty the odd associations and disjunctures that seemed to be showing up in her conversation? In any case, at a certain point, as she wandered out among the galaxies, among the whirling particles and ineffable numbers, something leaked in her mind, smudging the text of the cosmos, and she was lost. When their taxi approached the hospital on that first occasion, Sharon was dank and electric with terror. Her skin looked like wet plaster. Otto felt like an assassin as he led her in, and then she was ushered away somewhere. The others joined him in the waiting room and after several hours had the opportunity to browbeat various doctors into hangdog temporizing. Many people got better, didn't they? Had only one episode, didn't they? Led fully functioning lives. Why wouldn't Sharon be part of that statistic? She who was so able, so lively, so sweet, so, in a word, healthy. When would she be all right? That depended on what they meant by all right, one of the doctors replied. We mean by all right what you mean by all right, you squirrely bastard, Wesley shouted, empurpling. Martin paced, sizzling and clicking through his teeth, while Otto sat with his head in his hands, but the fateful, brutal, meaningless diagnosis had already been handed down. So, Otto and William visit Sharon, try to convince her to go to Thanksgiving. She's having none of that, but it's a very nice visit, and Sharon's in pretty good shape. And they talk about various things, including the nature of time. And afterwards, William and Otto are leaving. And William says, I've sometimes wondered if it might not be possible, in theory, to remember something that you, I mean, the aspect of yourself that you're aware of, haven't experienced yet, William said later. I mean, you really don't know whether time is linear, so would you stop that, Otto said. You're not insane. I'm merely speaking theoretically. Well, don't. And your memory has nothing to do with whether time is really, whatever you mean by that, linear. It's plenty linear for us. Cradle to grave, over the hill. It's a one-way street, my dear. My hair is not sometimes there and sometimes not there. We're not getting any younger. And besides, William, I wish you'd get back to your tennis. It's a bore, William said. Besides, you didn't want me playing with Jason, as I remember. Well, I was out of my mind, and at this point, it's your arteries I worry about. You know, William said, he put his graceful hand on Otto's arm. I don't think Sharon's any more unhappy than the rest of us, really, most of the time. That smile, I mean, that smile can't come out of nowhere. So then, now this is the part of the story in which everything happens, but I'm not going to read it to you. I'm going to skip the whole long, miserable Thanksgiving scene with the family and pick up afterwards. Otto and William are on their way home. You're right, as always, Otto said in the taxi later. They're no worse than anyone else's. They're all awful. I really don't see the point in it. Just think, garden, 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 two happy people And it could have gone on forever. They knew. They'd been told. But they ate it anyway. And from there on out, family. Shame, fear, jobs, mortality, envy, murder. Well, William said brightly, and sex. There's that, Otto conceded. In fact, William said, you could look at both family and mortality simply as byproducts of sexual reproduction. I don't really see the point of sexual reproduction either, Otto said. I wouldn't stoop to it. Actually, that's very interesting, you know, William said. They think that the purpose of sexual reproduction is to purge the genome of harmful mutations. Of course, they also seem to think it isn't working. Then why not scrap it, Otto said. Why not let us divide again like our dignified and immortal forebear, the amoeba? Well, William said, I suppose sexual reproduction is fairly entrenched by now. People aren't going to give it up without a struggle. And besides, family confers certain advantages as a social unit, doesn't it? No. What advantages? Oh, rudimentary education, William said, protection. Besides, it's broadening. You meet people in your family you'd never happen to run into otherwise. So now, William and Otto keep talking about this and that, and then Otto is left alone, sort of thinking. And he's thinking about Sharon. When one contemplated one's own apparently pointless, utterly trivial being, the questions hung all around one, as urgent as knives at the throat, but the instant one tried to grasp one of them and turn it to one's own purpose and pierce through the murk, it became as blunt and useless as a piece of cardboard. All one could dredge up were platitudes. One comes into the world alone, snore, snore. One, snore, snore, departs the world alone. So he keeps sort of thinking in this vein, and then he gets a phone call. And Sharon, I won't read you this part either. Sharon has been picked up by the police. There's some very unpleasant episode, and she's been taken off to the hospital. And Otto goes to fetch her, bring her home, and she's the doctor in charge is very handsome, rather dashing, and reasonably nice guy. And Otto, anyhow, he brings Sharon home, and then he goes home himself to William. There was a bottle of wine breathing on the table, and William had managed to maneuver dinner out of the mysterious little containers and the limp bits of organic matter from the fridge. Bad? William asked. Fairly, Otto said. Want to tell me? William said. Otto gestured impatiently. Oh, what's the point? Mustard with that? William said. It's good. I can't stand it that she has to live like this, Otto said. William shook his head. Everyone is so alone, he said. Otto yelped. What? William said. What did I do? Nothing, Otto said. He stood, trying to control his trembling. I'm going to my study. You go on upstairs when you get tired. Otto, just please. Otto sat downstairs in his study with the book in his hand, listening, while William rinsed the dishes and put them in the dishwasher and went finally upstairs. For some time, footsteps persisted oppressively in the bedroom overhead. When they ceased, Otto exhaled with relief. Well, if time was the multiplicity Sharon and William seemed to believe it was, maybe it contained multiple Sharons, perhaps some existing in happier conditions, before the tracks diverged, one set leading up to the stars, the other down to the hospital. Otto's mind wandered here and there amid the dimensions, catching glimpses of her skirt, her hair, her hand, as she slipped through the mirrors. Did things have to proceed for each of the Sharons in just exactly the same way? Did each one grieve for the Olympian destiny that ought to have been hers? Did each grieve for an ordinary life, a life full of ordinary pleasures and troubles, children, jobs, lovers? Everyone is so alone. For this, all the precious Sharons had to flounder through their loops and tucks of eternity. For this, the shutters were drawn on their aerial and light-filled minds. Each and every Sharon thrashing through the razor-edged days, only in order to be absorbed by this spongy platitude. Everyone is so alone. Great God, how could it be endured? All the Sharons, forever and ever, discarded in a phrase. So Otto spends the night and most of the next day sitting and sort of thinking about Sharon, sort of suffering. William is practicing for his concert. And then, now you remember Margaret and Naomi, the upstairs neighbors. They have adopted their baby, and they've come downstairs to introduce their new baby to Otto and William. This is the next evening. And this will be a sort of long passage that is the end. Margaret rolled a little white quilt out on the rug. Plunked down on it, the baby sat wobbling with an expression of surprise. "Look at her," William said. "Here's hoping," Margaret said, raising her glass. So, Otto thought, marvelous. Humans were born, they lived, they glued themselves together in little clumps, and then they died. It was no more, as William had once cheerfully explained, than a way for genes to perpetuate themselves. "The selfish gene," he'd said, quoting, probably detrimentally, someone, "you were put on Earth to fight for your DNA. Let the organisms chat. Let them talk. Their voices were as empty as the tinklings of a player piano. Let the organisms talk about this and that." It was what, as William had so trenchantly pointed out, this particular carbon-based life form did, just as its cousin, according to William, the roundworm, romped ecstatically beneath the surface of the planet. Otto tried to intercept the baby's glossy, blurry stare. The baby was actually attractive for a baby and not bald at all, as it happened. "Hello," Otto thought to it. "Let's you and I communicate in some manner far superior to the verbal one." The baby ignored him. Whatever she was making of the blanket, the table legs, the shod sets of feet, she wasn't about to let on to Otto. Well, see if he cared. William was looking at him. So what was he supposed to do? Oh, all right, he'd contribute, despite his current clarity of mind. "And how was China?" he asked. "Was the food as bad as they say?" Naomi looked at him blankly. "Well, I don't know, actually," she said. "Honey, how was the food?" "The food," Margaret said. "Not memorable, apparently." "The things people have to do in order to have children," Otto said. "Well, we toyed with the idea of giving birth," Margaret said. "That is, Naomi toyed with it." "At first," Naomi said, "I thought, what a shame to miss an experience that nature intended for us. And I mean, there was this guy at work, or of course there's all, but then I thought, what, am I an idiot? I mean, just because you've got arms and legs, it doesn't mean you have to, No, William said, but still, I can understand how you felt. Have to what? Margaret said. I can't, Otto said. Have to what? Margaret said. I can't understand it, Otto said. I've just never envied the capacity. Others are awestruck, not I. I've never even remotely wished I were able to give birth, and in fact, I've never wanted a baby. Of course, it's inhuman not to want one, but I'm just not human. I'm not a human being. William is a human being. Maybe William wanted a baby. I never thought to ask. Was that what you were trying to tell me the other day, William? Were you trying to tell me that I've ruined your life? Did you want a baby? Have I ruined your life? Well, it's too bad. I'm sorry. I was too selfish to ask if you wanted one, and I'm too selfish to want one myself. I'm more selfish than my own genes. I'm not fighting for my DNA. I'm fighting against it. I'm happy as I am, William said. He sat, his arms wrapped tightly around himself, looking at the floor. Who needs more champagne? You see, Otto said into the tundra of silence William left behind him as he retreated into the kitchen. I really am a monster. Miles away, Naomi sat blushing, her hands clasped in her lap. Then she scooped up the baby. There, there, she said. But Margaret sat back, eyebrows raised in semicircles, contemplating something that seemed to be hanging a few feet under the ceiling. Oh, I don't know, she said, and the room shuttled back into proportion. I suppose you could say it's human to want a child in the sense that it's biologically mandated, but I mean, you could say that, or you could say it's simply unimaginative, or you could say it's unselfish, or you could say it's selfish, or you could just say, well, I want one, but when you get down to it, really, one what? Because actually, I mean, well, look at Molly, I mean, actually, they're awfully specific. I abase myself, Otto told William as they washed and dried the champagne glasses. I don't need to tell you how deeply I'll regret having embarrassed you in front of Naomi and Margaret, how deeply I'll regret having been insufficiently mawkish about the miracle of life. I don't need to tell you how ashamed I'll feel the minute I calm down, how deeply I'll regret having trampled your life, and how deeply I'll regret being what I am. Well, that last part I regret already. I profoundly regret every tiny crumb of myself. I don't need to go into it all once again, I'm sure. Just send back the form, pertinent boxes checked. I intend to accept your forthcoming apology for... Please stop, William said. Oh, how awful to have ruined the life of such a marvelous man. Have I ruined your life? You can tell me, we're friends. Otto, I'm going upstairs now. I didn't sleep well last night, and I'm tired. Yes, go upstairs. Good night, William said. Yes, go to sleep, why not? Oh, it was like trying to pick a fight with a dog toy. Just you go on off to sleep. Otto, listen to me. My concert is tomorrow. I want to be able to play adequately. I don't know why you're unhappy. You do interesting work. You're admired. We live in a wonderful place. We have wonderful friends. We have everything we need and most of the things we want. We have excellent lives by anyone's standard. I'm happy, and I wish you were. I know that you've been upset these last few days. I asked if you wanted to talk. And you said you didn't. Now you do, but this happens to be the one night of the year when I most need my sleep. Can it wait till tomorrow? I'm very tired, and you're obviously very tired as well. Try and get some sleep, please. Try and get some sleep. Try and get some sleep. This is unbearable. I've spent the best years of my life with a man who doesn't know how to use the word and. and is not part of the infinitive, and means in addition to. It's not try and get some sleep, it's try to get some sleep. To. Please try to get some sleep. Otto sat down heavily at the kitchen table and began to sob. How arbitrary it all was, and cruel. This identity, that identity, Otto, William, Molly, the doctor. Sharon would be up now, sitting at her own kitchen table, the white enamel table with a cup of tea, thinking about something, about numbers streaming past in stately sequences, about remote astral pageants. The doctor had rested his hand kindly on his shoulder, and what she must have felt then. Oh, to convert that weight of the world's compassion into something worthwhile. The taste, if only she could have lifted his hand and kissed it, the living satin feel of his skin. Everyone had to put things aside, for good. The way they had smiled at one another, Sharon and that doctor. What can you do, their smiles had said. The handsome doctor in his handsome doctor suit, and Sharon in her disheveled lunatic suit. What a charade. In this life, Sharon's little spark of consciousness would be costumed inescapably as a waif at the margins of mental organization, and the doctor's would be costumed inescapably as a flashing exemplar of supreme competence. In this life, and frankly, there would be no other, the hospital was where they would meet. Otto, a hand was resting on Otto's shoulder. William, Otto said, it was William. They were in the clean, dim kitchen. The full moon had risen high over the neighbors' buildings, where the lights were almost all out. Had he been asleep? He blinked up at William, whose face, shadowed against the light of the night sky, was as inflected, as ample in mystery as the face in the moon. It's late, my darling, Otto said. I'm tired. What are we doing down here?
Thank you.